Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
How's your week been?
Oh, it's been busy, but a good week.
I have been swamped with a server that does not want to cooperate with me. And so it's been a very challenging about 2 weeks for me. But here we are.
Yes, here we are. We're going to have fun tonight.
Absolutely. Lots of articles to cover and a great topic that we're going to cover about compelled speech.
That sounds very interesting and unique. Compelled speech.
If you're listening to us via the website, we're delighted to have you, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you would make us part of your feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or TuneIn. If you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't, forget everything I just said. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. Even a dollar contribution would be appreciated endlessly. So this first article is titled The Sex Offender Registry: Vengeful, Unconstitutional, and for Full Repeal. It's from thehill.com. And it goes to a bunch of things that is talked about in the movement in general, that having a bunch of people listed on a registry of something that they did doesn't do anything to protect public safety, because the inverse of that 95% of sex crimes are committed by someone that's not on the registry. You're watching the wrong people.
Well, how do you watch the ones that haven't done anything yet, though? Therein lies the problem.
Certainly, but if it seems easy to make the argument then that you don't need to watch those people, other than just have generic public safety to tell people that these would be the people that are going to harm your kid, not those people. But I guess that's not what the people care for. The people are screaming to have these registries so that they know who lives next door.
They have decreed in their head that they have a right to know something that they don't have a right to know.
So nobody has a
And
right to
until,
know who lives next door?
well, you have the right to know to the extent that the information is public about your neighbor, which if the person owns the house, you'd probably be able to get ownership records. But I don't know of any inherent right that you have to go to someone's house and demand to know who lives there. I just don't know of such a right. I'm not familiar with that.
I guess the Fourth Amendment applies to from the government standpoint, but just using that as sort of a framework, you have the right to privacy, and so your neighbor does not have the right to know who lives next door.
Well, I'm not aware. Like I say, the courthouses record ownership information, but I'm not aware of any inherent right you have to know beyond that who's in the home. So it's an invented right that politicians have, in response to high profile cases, have invented this right, but it really isn't there. There is no right to know. Now, you could argue that there's a right to know for people who are serving community punishment. Because they're paying a debt to society, and how they're paying that debt is up for society to determine what the parameters are. Certainly, if they were in a correctional institution, you would know where they are. So perhaps you could make the argument while a person's being punished that you have a right to know. But I don't know of any right. I'm pushing back, and I'm encouraging everyone who's a supporter of the movement. When people say there's a right to know, say, where does that right derive from? Where do you have a right to know?
Is the registry itself some form of double jeopardy or punishment after, we'll stick with after your sentence is over?
Well, the Supreme Court of the United States seemed to suggest that in the Packingham case, that they had dicta in there that for people who they were particularly troubled by the restrictions that were applied to people after they paid the debt to society, which has been an argument of mine for many years, is that if we concentrate on those who've paid their debt to society, and if we can't convince society that they should not punish those people any further by humiliating and degrading their quality of life, we're never going to win this battle, because that's the lowest common denominator, the lowest hanging fruit. We shouldn't be doing this to anybody. But if we can't start somewhere, which would be people who've paid their debt in full, then if we can't win the public on that, then we can't win the public on anything.
So people on paper would still, perhaps, ultimately the goal would be to get them off, to get the whole thing taken down. But the low-hanging fruit would be to go after the ones that have finished their sentences. And what does that say? This kind of goes outside of the article, though. But in some states, even after you've finished your sentence, you are then, you know, you have like 1,000-foot living restrictions and so forth. Does that, where does that fit into the equation?
Well, there that arguments are being asserted across the country that those additional conditions. As a matter of fact, this article that we're talking about discussed that is a form of additional punishment, and it's violating in the writer's opinion multiple aspects of the Constitution because of double jeopardy and continuous punishment after the fact. So we in the movement, we should never say that when a reporter says, doesn't the public have a right to know? Our advocates always say yes, and we should say no. But where do they derive that right now after a person's paid their debt to society? Perhaps you can make the argument that they have the right to know if the person is in community paying their debt to society. If you're serving a period of probation or parole, perhaps the argument can be made that we have the right to know where the people who are under our courts and our correctional facility supervision are. But when that time has ended, you have no right to know. And I will not amuse you by saying, yes, you have a right to know. No, you do not have a right to know. Well, I hope I'm not the only one that says that at the end of the day, that others will stop saying that, well, yes, you have a right to know, because no, you do not have a right to know that. If you do have that right, please let me know where you derive that right.
No, and I agree with you. And I'm trying really hard to come up with any way to push back and give you further. I don't know why I have any right to know if I want to go knock on my neighbor's door and say, hi, who are you? And they can just say, F you people, and move on. I don't have any right to go any further.
They should be able to do that.
Right? No, that's what I'm saying. I don't have any right to, I can go knock on the door and I can ask, but they can just say, fuck you. Okay. And yeah. I don't have any recourse. So how do I have the right to be able to look up on the internet? How do people believe that they have the right to go look up on the internet and see who lives next door?
Well, because when high-profile cases like Megan Kanka happened, when there was a debate in the legislature, I believe that was New Jersey where Megan
yes.
Kanka was the case. No one showed up in response to when the advocates of that law said, we have a right to know. No one stood up and said, well, actually, you don't. But in Megan's case, I think he may have still been under supervision when he was initially released, but I'm not sure. That's been a long time ago. But perhaps the argument could have been made that they had that right. But the victims, the advocates were for the Megan's Law were saying, hey, we could have protected ourselves if we had known, if we had been told, and why weren't we told? That was their argument for the registry for the Megan's Law, for the notification provision. So, like I said, I don't recall specifically
even to extrapolate it out, though, you have asserted, and I've heard other attorneys assert, that once you're done. Has our system decided that you have been rehabilitated? If our system says that you have not been rehabilitated, well, then there should be something further to go along with it from the start, making it not ex post facto. If they deem that you should be on lifetime monitoring, well, then you should be on lifetime monitoring. It shouldn't be something that, well, like in Pennsylvania, where they said, oh, hey, we're going to change the rules.
I agree. And of course, with determinate sentencing, a person being rehabilitated is not a part of the equation. When they've done the determined time, they're free. Whether it worked or not is another matter, but that's not part of the analysis.
Sure.
That's with indeterminate sentencing. If you give a person 7 to 25 years, if you determine that they've been sufficiently rehabilitated after 7, you can release them. But if it's a determinate sentence, it matters not whether they've been rehabilitated.
And you and I, this is going to be something that we're going to talk about in a future episode, about the statistics side of it. When laws are being formed, do the politicians take expert opinion from psychiatrists, sociologists, etc., the professionals that monitor the brain and attitudes? Is that input ever solicited to find out what best practice would be?
Well, it varies to some degree. We've got a lot of states who have part-time legislatures who don't have huge budgets for paying experts to come in. So the processes are very haphazard. If a person wants to come in pro bono, make an argument, which is rare, they do that. But but usually it's advocacy groups that do the advocating, and those are usually criminal justice driven. The law enforcement, the system itself, it'd be the prosecutors, the police, the sheriffs. It's rare that you see in testimony the victims' advocates tend to be a little bit better funded, or quite a bit better funded. But the people on our side, we usually come in with some ragtag, if anybody at all, because we don't have the resources. When you go to the Ford Foundation and say, we'd like some philanthropic support, well, what are you doing? Well, we're advocating to make the process fair for people accused of crimes and make sure that the laws are made that give them every bit of due process they're entitled to and not too harsh. The philanthropies just don't jump all over that and say, well, gee, how much can we sign up for? So it's hard for us to bring those type of people to the table. It really difficult. So not as much as you'd like to think they are. They're not involved.
So I don't really want to like highlight this next article very much, but it's from the Washington Post about a man accused and convicted of raping a 13-year-old. But specifically in here, so the judge is catching a whole bunch of heat for the deal that was pled out to, and the guy was pled to 20 years of probation. And so the judge, Craig Ladd, said this, Larry. What did he, what was his reason for just giving the 20-year plea?
What was the judge's reason?
Yeah, the judge provided I'm sorry. It's the district attorney.
Yeah, I was going to say it was the district attorney. So, well, the uproar is largely driven by people who are not fully understanding how the system works. So cases that are brought against people, they're not all of the same quality case. And quality, I'm speaking quality from the prosecution side. So for the defense side, that would be a different argument about the quality of the defense. But on the quality of the case, a prosecutor evaluates something they're willing to do based on the strength of the case and the evidence. In this case, the prosecutor felt that the case was very weak. The accusations themselves seem rather I don't know what the proper word would be, but they were unflattering. You wouldn't find what he was accused of doing. The church camp, I believe it was, yes. that he forcibly took advantage of a minor. But there was no evidence that the prosecutor felt comfortable would secure a conviction. So the prosecutor decided, I need a conviction on this guy because he's a repeat offender. And I don't have the evidence that's likely to get me there unless I make a sweetheart deal. So the prosecutor made a sweetheart offer for the guy, and the judge agreed. Judges can reject plea agreements if they so choose, but the prosecutor said, without the case, that there would have been the prosecutor was named Ladd. He said he had witness problems that were so severe that the only alternative was dismissal. Well, the public is choosing to ignore that. I could have let the guy not be accountable at all for this offense, or I can make a probated offer, and based on his history of having difficulty complying, we'll probably get him on a probation violation soon. And then we'll have the full latitude of sentencing options that we would have had we convicted him. So we can get him later. But so they're going to impeach a good judge and recall whatever the process is on Oklahoma, who was simply trying to protect the community and accepted a deal so that a guy would be accountable for what he did. But we've got unsophisticated people out there that are ready to hang the judge, and they'll be changing the law. Just like they did in California with the Stanford swimmer, with Brock Turner, they'll be changing the law in Oklahoma that no probated sentence like this can ever be offered in the future. So it'll be an overreaction, but that's what we can expect, how this will play out. The public backlash is significant as far as I can tell, and it certainly was in the Brock Turner case.
Sure. So moving on. So the Star Telegram has an article that says Tarrant County judge used electric shocks to punish sex offender who is now getting a new trial. So let me ask you a couple of questions, Larry. Can a judge compel you to answer questions?
Yes, in some circumstances, particularly when you've chosen to waive your Fifth Amendment right and to testify. You don't have to testify. This defendant didn't have to testify, but apparently he took the stand.
So can you then still refuse? Can you say, nope, I don't want to answer these questions?
Becomes very problematic. I think this was just basic questions from the judge about his, about how did he plead. And I think that he would have been way out of order to refuse to answer the questions about what his name was.
And I see where you're going with that. But the next question is, can they ever physically harm you for not answering a question?
Absolutely not. That was over the top. If this is a true account of what this judge did, Judge Gallagher needs to be referred to the Judicial Disability or Standards or whatever commission they have in Texas to find out what sort of rehabilitation or possible removal proceedings if this is the first instance of the judge. But no, you can't use those techniques to compel a person to, I'm shocked. I've never heard of a person actually having that stuff hooked to them in a courtroom in my state, but apparently in the Lone Star State, they do things like that for a person who might become violent. But that's why he was hooked up to the electrical apparatus. But this is going to get criticism. He apparently ordered the bailiff to inflict the voltage if the accounting is correct of what happened. And this goes to show us, because we're always so proud of ourselves and we separate ourselves as Americans, how different we are from, we say the Third Reich was so horrible and they followed orders.
Yes.
Okay. This is a person who should have said, no, sir, Your Honor, I cannot do that.
Absolutely.
I cannot and will not do that. But he didn't do that. If the story is true, and I always like to give the benefit of the doubt because the judge hasn't been convicted of doing this, but assuming that these facts as alleged are true, the person should have refused to have carried out that order. That device is here if he gets unruly and tries to jump and lunge at a witness. But that's not here because it's making Your Honor happy. And of course, he might well have lost his job. But that, as Americans, we're supposed to be the unique and model to the world of how we stand up against evil. And he did not stand up against evil if this is true.
It's very bizarre. There's a quote in there in the article that says, hit him again. I can just see it. Hit him again! Oh my God. I just can't. Can you imagine like the people in the courtroom, the visitors there and the jury? Good grief.
Gallagher ordered the bailiff to administer electric shocks on the first day of his trial. When Gallagher asked Morris for his plea of guilty, Morris refused to answer the question, which I don't think you can. Of course, the lawyer should have stood up and said, Your Honor, we're having a trial because his plea is not guilty.
Right.
So, but apparently he was not on good terms with his attorney either, as the story goes. He'd fired a couple of attorneys and he didn't trust his attorney.
Okay. So this article, I'll be frank with you. I don't even understand the words that I'm reading. It is, to me, it's high-end legal theory kind of things. But so it's from the Daily Signal. This case could help prevent Congress from outsourcing its power. And I'm really hoping that you can dig into this one a little bit. They're talking about SORNA and things with Congress and delegation of authority, and it really, really just hurts my head.
Yeah, well, we come up with these stories, and then sometimes I say we should do a podcast on, because this is one where we can touch on it briefly, but we ought to do a podcast on this one.
Okay.
Because it's so complicated. So they're moving parts in this. So what people have to separate themselves from is the Adam Walsh Act was not the beginning of registration. So by 2006, when this Adam Walsh Act passed, which had the SORNA component, every state had a registry for the better part of 10 years, and some for even longer. But there was registration of sex offenders in all the states in our country. So what Congress was trying to do was to get those registries working collectively as possible, because they didn't see a way to create a federal registry. So this is a long answer to a question of trying to explain it. So you've got 50 registries that are out there operating prior to 2006, and you still have 50 registrars today for all the states. But the what needed to happen, as far as Congress was concerned, is that there didn't need to be offenders disappearing from the grid. And as I've said before, and this is one of those things that causes consternation from our supporters, if you have 50 registries operating and a person left the jurisdiction of Florida and they go to the jurisdiction of Alabama, let's take them to Arizona, but they leave the state of Florida and they go to Arizona. Under the old system, prior to Adam Walsh Act, Florida was happy that they were gone, and Arizona did not know that they were there because they had left without. So Florida was drinking tequila and celebrating their departure because that was one less person that was going to be a problem for them. And Arizona did not know they were there because they had chosen to go off grid. So Congress thought, well, gee, if we've asked these states to have registries and the people can simply go off grid, then what do we do to federalize it so that we can bring the feds in? Because we can't have a federal registry because these are state crimes, and we can't mandate registration for state crimes. We can't do that. So they passed the toughened standards saying you registering officials need to meet these minimum standards. You need to communicate with one another. And we're also going to pass a law that says if you travel from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as a registered person, you don't register in a new jurisdiction, that's going to be a federal crime. It brings the entire resources that Florida didn't choose to, when you'd left Florida, when you were in Arizona, Florida didn't want to spend their money because they had no desire to have you back. From their point of view, they were happy you were gone.
Yeah.
So the federal government was the only way that they could bring massive investigative resources to find that person who had made their way to Arizona. So the question became, when they passed that, they delegated to the Attorney General of the United States, who at the time was Alberto Gonzalez, when we're under President George W. Bush, the authority to determine how to deal with the retroactivity. This was not the retroactivity of creating registration. We already had that. This was the retroactivity in terms of how to apply, whether we're going to subject previous offenders to the new federal standards that if you traveled, hypothetically, you could have not included anybody who was previously convicted and registered to 06, and you could have said these are brand new crimes that we will only prosecute people for who were convicted from 2006 forward. And then you would have had a good, clean registry for the federal prosecutions, because there would be no question that if you committed a sex crime after July 7th or whatever it was in 2006, that became law, that there was no ex post facto application. But what you have happening is the Federal Fugitive Task Force that was created started a massive apprehension of people who had chosen not to register in their new states. And then the question became, can you federally prosecute them? So that's what all this delegation to Attorney General Gonzalez, and he delegated and decided that they could be prosecuted. Whether or not that was constitutional for Congress to duck and say, well, we're going to let the AG decide that, whether or not that this applies retroactively. We're not going to decide that. We're going to let the legal expert decide that. So that's what's the issue in the Gundy case, is whether or not that delegation was constitutional to let the Attorney General decide how to deal with whether it was retroactive or prospective. He decided it was retroactive.
All right. So let me try and decide or talk about this from...
That's why we need a whole program, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I'm with you. So the AG is the federal, the top law enforcement official. He's not a legislator.
That would be crazy. He's an officer in the federal system. He's an officer of the executive branch,
right,
appointed by the president, which in this case at the moment is Donald Trump, but that was George Bush and Alberto Gonzalez.
And I think what you then just said is that he doesn't have the authority to determine this stuff. That would have to be done at the legislation level. I think that's what you said.
Well, the Congress decided that we're going to create this federal crime of traveling in interstate commerce to apprehend sex offenders. That's where the big consternation is, because people who were convicted many years before 06 have been prosecuted because they moved across jurisdictional boundaries without registering. It's not whether or not they should have to register, period. It's about the federal component of prosecution. the people get very convoluted about the Adam Walsh Act 2006 didn't say you have to make your registry any more retroactive than it already is, with the exception of one small provision. They do have a reach back provision for people previously convicted who have not that are no longer in the justice system in any fashion. There's a reach back provision where the states are supposed to go back and grab them if they get convicted of a felony level offense. And if their previous conviction was a tier one offense and 15 years haven't lapsed, they're supposed to reach back and bring them in. If it's a tier two offense, they're supposed to reach back if 25 years haven't lapsed. And if it's a tier three offense, until you're dead, they reach back and bring you in. But that was only retroactivity. But people were being prosecuted. So they may have moved from Florida to Arizona in 2003.
Right.
Well, the Walsh Act didn't exist in 2003.
Right.
So the interstate travel predated the Walsh Act. But the marshals started rounding those people up immediately. As soon as they got the funding and the authority, they started looking for those missing registered citizens who had exempted themselves from registration. So through court challenges, the courts have decided that you cannot prosecute anyone whose travel itself predated the Adam Walsh Act. And then it's been expanded to be till Alberto issued his regulation. When he interpreted it, he pronounced his regulation, Attorney General Gonzalez, until he issued his, and I believe that came in 07. So if your travel predated 07, the feds couldn't prosecute you. But then we've had a decade pass since then where people have traveled. But this brings into the question of people who traveled after Gonzalez's proclamation, because if the Congress delegating to Attorney General Gonzalez the authority to determine it was retroactive, if that was wrong and Congress should have made that determination, then these prosecutions over the last decade would all be called into question.
Okay.
Because that would nullify. If he didn't have the authority to determine that it was retroactive, then, and Congress didn't proclaim this as a prospective enforcement, you got a real murky situation. That's what the Gundy case is about.
This is really, really complicated. But that's interesting.
It's going to be very difficult for the court, because the court isn't going to want to nullify 10 years worth of prosecutions that have taken place or bring into question 10 years worth of prosecutions that have taken place. So it's going to be a very difficult case for them to figure out how to resolve it. But they accepted, they granted certiorari. So we're going to see what they do.
Tell me that word again. Certiorari?
Certiorari. I hear it all sorts of different ways, but they granted cert. If you stick with cert, then you'll always be okay. But they granted cert, and they're going to hear this case and decide. And there are people that are hoping for them to on the conservative side, hoping that they will come down and say that Congress didn't have the power to do that.
But what does that cert mean? What's that term mean?
It means that they decided to review the case.
Oh, that's all it
means? The Supreme Court gets to decide what cases it wants to hear.
Why do they use big, complicated words to say something very simple?
So except for the cases that the Supreme Court must hear, like disputes between states themselves, except for a few cases, they get to decide what they hear.
Right.
So you don't file an appeal to the Supreme Court generally. You file a petition for cert, and they get thousands and thousands of them.
Yeah,
somewhere between 7,000 and 9,000 every year.
Jesus,
and they grant 80 to 90. So you've got about
that
a
many?
Chance.
Oh, geez, man, I didn't know it was that many.
So they may select 75 to 90 cases in any term. So you've got a very low chance of your case being granted review, even though there are so many thousands. You spend a lot of money getting your petition filed, and it's going to get a one-line rejection. Let's say your petition for certiorari has been denied.
Right, right. All right, so moving on, and this is from Time Magazine, or Time.com, and it's something we've been talking about following along, is the deal in California where they're going to take a whole bunch of people. Oh, how did they word it? So Governor Jerry Brown's administration will appeal the order by Sacramento County Superior Court Judge Alan Summer. The judge previously said in a tentative ruling that prison officials must rewrite part of the parole regulations in a ballot measure passed by voters. Voters voted on Proposition 57 in a 2-1 margin that they need to reduce the prison population. And then the governor's turning around and saying, well, wait, not everybody. Sex crimes and other violent crimes don't count. But that's not what the voters did. So this is going to be interesting to me to see how it goes through, where you've got the government fighting itself over what the voters voted for.
It is going to be very interesting, and this would be a good one to have someone from California that knows that proposition system better than I do. I know that I think there were some exclusions in the proposition itself, but not as broad as what the administration has done. So this is an example of administrative overreach, similar to what we talked about on the previous podcast of the, I think we talked about it, of the visitation where the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has excluded sex offenders from contact visitation and overnight visitation. And that's not what the voters did. So the lower level judge is being appealed, and it's going to be fun to watch how it plays out, because this will tell us, once it's all settled, how far that the state can go beyond what the intent of the initiative was. And give Janice Bellucci a shout out here. I think she's involved in this case.
Yeah, she's quoted in the article a couple of times.
So for those who don't know, she's an attorney who has been active for years and fighting proximity and residency restrictions in California. And now she's taken some of her initiative national.
Yeah. Bellucci argued that the language of the ballot measure requires earlier parole consideration for any sex crime not on the state's narrow list of 23 violent felonies, which include murder, kidnapping, and forcible rape. So, yeah, that's going to be neat to see how it goes down, that the voters voted for something and then the governor saying, no, we can't do that.
So, that regulatory process, they're doing the same thing with the visitation. Okay. So you've got a very hard-nosed executive branch that has decided that it's going to exclude everybody from early release, which goes contrary to the intent to see they're not releasing the prison populations merely because they have a change of heart.
Right.
They had a federal lawsuit that declared them grossly in violation of the Constitution by their overcrowding. They told them to reduce their population. And so, or they could either need to do that or build more prisons.
Yes.
But they gave them a limitation on how many that could be in the facilities that they had. And they decided that they were going to reduce population. But you can't reduce population if you don't let anyone out.
It seems kind of not going to work out very well, does it?
So, we had a governor here named Gary Puff Johnson. And the Puff I put in for because he was in his final couple of years, he started pushing for marijuana legalization when he fought it all his political career. But he used to do a trek for trash. He was a bicyclist enthusiast, and he would go around and do a trek for trash, and all the cameras were rolling, and he would actually get off his bicycle and pick up some trash. He said, this program only works if somebody picks up the trash. Well, you can't reduce prison population with merely lip service. You have to let people out. Hmm. And you can't just have everyone locked up because you're mad at them. We should use prisons for people that we're afraid of that do very harmful things, not because we're frustrated with them that they didn't pay a fine or that they've extended their curfew or some crazy stuff that we put people in prison for. We need to find other less expensive methods of dealing with offenders rather than locking everyone up. And California and Texas and some of these states have spent themselves almost to the brink with excessive high incarceration.
So, and I'm going to pull back from some memory here on that particular deal. So, as I recall, California has about an 80,000 person capacity, and they were running it at around 132. So that's just a number that sticks out in my head. So they were almost double capacity.
It was horrendously overcrowded, yes.
And then you had people like, hey, well, we need to put them somewhere, so we'll just put them in the gymnasium. So they just, stack in all the bunks in the gymnasium. Well, now where do they have any sort of rec? So now they can't have rec. And people were fighting over socks. I mean, that's how bad it was. Like, the resources were depleted so bad that the inmates are in there, they can't get socks. Well, now what do you really? You can't even put on socks?
See, the average citizen doesn't understand the complexity of sound correctional, the benefit and the complexity. When you have facilities that are grossly overcrowded, the systems themselves break down.
Absolutely.
You're taxing everything beyond its capacity. You design a kitchen to prepare so many meals a day. You design sanitation services to handle so many flushes per day.
Right, right.
And you have medical... a sick base, and you have all these things for so many people. and staffing for so many people. And when you get grossly beyond those levels, you have systemic breakdown all across the system. And it makes you feel good to just say, we'll pack them in there. But you have a very unsafe environment for the staff, and you have a totally broken system that's not doing anything other than running a gross warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've spent all your money on this system that has accomplished very little because you haven't done anything other than warehouse people in horrendous conditions. And then you wonder why they don't succeed when they come out. But that's what we do.
So when you have people in that level of resource restraint where they can't, you know, they can't even put on clean socks, then the only way to get clean socks would be to go knock the dude next to you over the head. And yeah, you wonder why they come out of prison with the very twisted mindset of, you know, not vigilante justice, but just some sort of animal instinct, predatory attitude about things.
Well, like I say, everything breaks down when a system is overcrowded. The laundry facilities can't keep up.
Yeah.
The educational classes, you've got so many instructors and so many classes to the extent that you're offering a rehabilitation, those break down because you can't provide any services. The library breaks down.
Yeah.
Everything in the system breaks down. Transport breaks down. And you just can't run a facility like that. When you start getting a facility above 75-80% of its operating design capacity, you start having real strain on every system that it has, and it doesn't work when you do that.
So let's move on to something happier.
Let's do that.
So in Vernon, Florida, the Vernon City Council is in the process of adopting an ordinance that would prohibit sex offenders and predators from living in the city limits. So, I mean, I all I can take out of this one is this one's just banishment. City limits, you can't live here.
I'm hoping that our Florida Action Committee and their connections just to totally ban people.
But how many people is it? How many people is it that they're trying to ban from Vernon? It's seven.
It's seven
people that they're trying to, like, the city council resources to, like, vote on. I guess they would be voting on apportioning, like, the city permits to grow commerce, etc. But they're going to focus their effort on seven people. Like, you don't know who those seven people are already?
So, well, not according to Mayor Tina Sloan. Great shout out for you, Tina. Great job. Said it would be a good idea for us to address the issue. It was recommended to us by our attorney because she has been working with other communities who are adopting the ordinances. So, and there's some truth in that because when you don't have statewide preemption by either judicial interpretation or by state statute, such as we have, then the communities themselves become tempted to try to draw larger circles and to try to be tougher because they don't want people moving into their town or their county. So this is competition at its finest.
And then at the end of the article, Wausau Town Council is also considering a similar ordinance. The council will discuss the proposed ordinance meeting on Thursday at 6 p.m. Gotta love it. That's good stuff.
So Wausau, I think that is, if it's pronounced the way they do it in Wisconsin. Maybe not. You know, we have counties in Georgia that are spelled just like a city in Texas. And they pronounce it completely different.
I don't know anything about that one. Hey, so from Wisconsin Public Radio, they must have heard the podcast that we talked about the GPS monitoring, and they wrote an article about it. So Wisconsin doubles GPS monitoring despite 5 years of malfunctions and unnecessary jailings. So I guess when I said I don't have a problem with it, these might be some of the things that I might have a problem with. So if your GPS monitor decides to stop phoning home and you get arrested, that's lovely.
Well, not being a big tech proponent as yourself, as you are, I mean, tech never fails, but we've known about these problems with GPS. They run into zones where they can't connect with a satellite for whatever reasons. And I'm by no means a tech guru, so I can only talk in the most elementary terms, but we've known about them losing communication with a satellite when you're certain structures. And that bringing the person non-compliance. We've known about the bracelet on the two-piece units not communicating properly with the box. So these problems are longstanding. They're not new. Technology has its problems.
So there's a segment in this article where it says an individual he started having problems with the monitor as soon as he started wearing it, And it's because where his grandmother lives, he's got really bad cell reception. So even though the police found him exactly where he was supposed to be, they still took him to jail for 3 days. And as a result, he lost his job at a family restaurant.
Well, don't you think the restaurant should be more tolerant? I mean, they, after all, they gave a person on the registry a chance. And if he doesn't show up for work, don't you think he should lose his job?
I guess they could just say, fuck you people.
That's what they did say. They said, gee, it's not our problem that you have these technological issues. We've been pretty generous to give you an opportunity, and you can't be reliable. Of course, he can't be reliable because he was hauled away to detention. So, yeah, there are a lot of false alerts, and some probation supervising officers take those with a different level of intensity than others. Some are more aggressive, and that's the problem when you have humans making these decisions, or we should have a robot making a decision, because you got a PO where a person, they lose communication with a satellite for a short period of time, and well, it's by the book. I can't know where they are, so I'm going to lock them up. And you got another PO that says, well, it was only 8 minutes. He couldn't have done much in 8 minutes.
But they found him where he was supposed to be.
Well, that's correct. But how long was he? How long was he not in contact with the device and the satellite? Where could he have been during all that time? See, that raises the issue of how long you can be off radar.
So what's the solution there? So we just have some level of trust. We should have some level of we put more people on the street to watch our offenders more closely. This isn't necessarily just related to sex offenders either. This is just the GPS issue in general.
This is the technological universe of electronic monitoring. And the solution, of course, in a perfect world, if we had people that didn't have inherent biases, we would hope they would make an intelligent, informed decision based on the unique situation that offender has.
But wait a minute. So isn't probation supposed to be like the original intent was supposed to help you reintegrate back into society?
Yes, but if the monitoring is if you're off grid for 11 and a half hours, a lot can go wrong in 11 and a half hours. But if you're off grid for 11 and a half minutes, there's a lot less things you can do depending on where you are. Your last word in the 11 minutes between the time you reappear. So, but that would require an individualized analysis, wouldn't it?
I think that would require some sort of personal relationship with your probation officer for them to determine whether you're a scumbag or not.
And then, okay, if it's 11 and a half minutes, what about 34 minutes?
I know. So where's the cutoff point? So now you have one lenient person versus another one that's, you know, militant.
So just lock them all up and let it be sorted out later. Unfortunately, this is an expensive proposition because the guy's paying money in all likelihood for the GPS, but he lost his job.
Yep.
And so society did not benefit from this. If he was trying to comply, which the story says he was, society has not benefited by what was taken from him, which was in his connection to employment and community support.
So from the Minot Daily News, Minot, North Dakota, gotta love it. The North Dakota Supreme Court ruled Thursday that the state can destroy convicted sex offender James Kremer's laptop and portable hard drive, but must return his Xbox and PlayStation to his family. All right, so you're accused of a crime, you're potentially convicted of a crime. They come take your stuff as evidence. And this could be anything from a car that was used in a drug deal. This could be computers used perhaps to distribute CP, whatever. They take it, and then it's at their discretion of whether they return any of it.
Apparently so, and I didn't catch on when I first perused this story that this was the Supreme Court. I was thinking this was a trial-level court, but this is the law of the state now because it was the Supreme Court, correct?
That's what I read out of it too. But so an Xbox and a PlayStation are as much computers as computers are. And I know this isn't your forte subject. I'm asking you these questions from the point of view of just it being evidence. So if you get caught with an ounce of weed in your car, they can impound your car and never give it back? Is that a true thing?
Well, not usually. They usually take the contraband, but the car generally is returned to you if it was impounded for some reason.
I'm thinking that if you loaded the car and you took off the door panels and all of that, then they might keep the car.
So, but the sex offender laptop and portable hard drive must return his Xbox. So what they're keeping is the computer itself and the hard drive.
Right. But you can, with freely available software, you could go the GBI, whoever, the North Dakota Department of Investigation, whatever. They could find those things that they find offensive and remove them and digitally scrub them to the point that they are irretrievable even by the NSA, and they could then still return that equipment.
Well, they could, but apparently that in North Dakota, it may be that this is one of the things where the seizure is a part of the punishment. If seizure of the computer is a part of the punishment, that was a law that was made by the people of the state of North Dakota. I don't know the specifics of if that was part of the punishment, but their asset forfeitures happen, and things are seized as a part of the punishment. So it does, at first blush, I don't see. I agree with you that they could have returned it to him, but they also could seize it.
Can you give an example of them seizing something else as part of punishment? Another example, so that I have something to ground my decision on, my opinion.
Well, they seize vehicles from drunk drivers. They seize assets from people who engage in illicit activities. The fruits of those assets are seized as part of the punishment. They seize houses, real estate. There's a lot of stuff that's seized as a part of the punishment. You, it's not uncommon at all.
Hmm. The person committed the crime, not the thing, as people always use in the gun cases.
People flip on that. See, that's the part of the hypocrisy of people, and then they'll get mad and write us ugly text for saying this. But by the analogy that they use on guns, then absolutely you would not seize the car, and you would not seize the assets of the person. The assets didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But the argument is that the person who builds up an illegal, using ill-gotten profits from trading drugs, and they buy real estate and put it in legitimate businesses, should they be able to benefit from the fruits of the illegal trade? So that's how the asset seizures come to be. And then the vehicle seizure is that the vehicle is the part of the problem. See, by your exact interpretation of the guns don't kill people, do you could never seize a vehicle because the vehicle didn't do anything wrong.
Correct. The vehicle's just going to sit there until somebody drives it.
It would never do anything wrong by itself.
Right.
But they do an amazing flip-flop, and that's what we battle against, our own inconsistencies of ourselves, because we don't get called out and challenged enough on that, but that is absolutely an inconsistency. The NRA ought to be saying, no, we don't seize cars, because cars don't kill people. People do.
And same thing with the computer. The computer didn't go down, do anything illegal. The person did it. It was a tool to make that happen. So why... I can see where you're going with the asset forfeiture is part of the punishment. I'm looking at the thing as being something more than just, I guess, just from like a monetary standpoint of the punishment. I'm looking at it as something different than that.
Well, he was probably making the argument that the computer was necessary for if he's getting did he get a probated sentence? No, he's serving 10 years in prison. He probably wouldn't need the computer much for the next 10 years.
No, probably not. And by the time he would get out, it's not going to be worth
it. It would be useless.
But he's saying that there's tax records and education information and stuff on there. So that's almost like, let's see if I can make this leap. You push over the file cabinet and it kills somebody. Therefore, they seize all of the documents inside of it as punishment in the murder of the person that had the file cabinet pushed over on them.
That would make perfect sense to me, right?
I'm trying to see if that
that's
analogy.
It's a good analogy.
Does it work?
At first blush, I'd have some questions about them not giving him his stuff back, even if they're going to keep the computer. They should have made all that stuff digitally available for him.
Bingo.
Stuff
that's
that
what
non,
I'm saying.
Non-porn related.
The computer itself, I mean, like the equipment is cheap. It's that data. I mean, if he's got tax records, yes, you should have paper copies, blah, 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 whatever. We live in a digital society, not wholly, but once you people die off, we'll be good.
Now, what age do this, us people count? So I know when does the dying have to be complete?
Older than me.
Oh, okay. So I would qualify. I need to die.
Yes. All right. So moving on. Vox.com. How predictive algorithms are being abused for non-consensual porn. People are manipulating artificial intelligence to non-consensually put women's faces in fake situations. This has been going on forever, though, but now you can make it happen for porn. You know, people have been cutting one image off of another one and putting somebody's face on another person's body. And I mean, hell, there are pictures of Trump on Time magazine. I mean, that's the same thing. But here they're being used in sexual situations. And they're turning it into a virtual reality, so now you could have sex with, forgive me, Alyssa Milano.
Who the hell is that?
Never mind. Pick whoever. So Raquel Welch, whoever you want to have sex with, put that person into a virtual reality thing, and now you can have sex with that person. And so that's where we are. So now this feels like thought crime to me.
So it does, Andy.
All right, we can move on. All right, Alabama schools struggle with juvenile sex offenders in classrooms. And this is from the Montgomery Advertiser. And so if your kid does something inappropriate, so the 3 years ago, their daughter was victimized by a then 14-year-old boy. What happened next combines the heartache of a family trying to get back to normal, a young man paying his debt to society, old wounds being reopened, and a bureaucratic maze of Board of Education meetings and potential legislative action. So the person who committed the offense then runs into the victim's brother in school, and he just kind of loses his mind that this person's back in school. I feel like I'm kind of sitting on the fence on this one. But if you've been adjudicated and you are now back to society, should there be any restrictions on what you do like that?
Well, I think that it's tragic that this is even an issue, because the boy at the time that we're talking about was 14 years old.
Yep.
And so you have to give kudos to Alabama that they didn't lock everybody up, because apparently you got a probated sentence.
Yeah. Adjudicated and delinquent.
And was put in the community. But unfortunately, Alabama does register juveniles. And apparently there's been enough of a leakage. My first glance of Alabama law is that he's tagged as a level one, which would not make him on the internet. But apparently they put juveniles on the internet, which I find despicable that any state would do that. But apparently they put him on the internet, did not put him on the internet, but yet the brother would have known. And the brother is all freaked out that he's at school. But until you're 16, you must go to school. So you've got a situation where the authorities have properly adjudicated the young man doesn't need to be incarcerated. And part of his rehabilitation is to continue his schooling. And the brother is saying, well, he shouldn't be allowed to go to school here. So what should he do? Where should he go to school? Is this going to be where we're going to have separate but equal? Are we going to go back to those days?
Segregation?
If he's a 14-year-old and he needs to go to school, I don't know many 14-year-olds that could go out and support themselves. So it's not like he can say, Dad, Mom, we're out of here. So we're going to move, and I'm transferring to another school district. Dad, you're going to support me. I mean, well, what is he supposed to do? He goes back to school where he went to school. But now they're trying to bar him from going to school, apparently, and there's been legislation introduced that would have that potentially that outcome, if I read it correctly, to deal with this issue. You see that there's a Senator Clyde Chambliss from Prattville is sponsoring a bill that would change the way notification and enrollment of juvenile sex offenders is handled, and the bill is passed out of the Senate.
So then the results would be, well, it says that, like, while many states such as Georgia do not allow juvenile sex offense registration at all.
Nor do we. But go ahead.
So in Alabama, they've decided that at any age you could be listed as a sex offender. And so what are you supposed to do? And it even says in the article, and youth sex offenders are statistically less likely than are both adult sex offenders and juveniles who committed non-sex offense to reoffend. So now they're going to introduce legislation to make it worse for somebody that is, what we're going to talk about in a future episode, statistically not likely to reoffend.
Well, that's probably not what's driving this bus. I don't think that that's the concern. The concern is he acted out and he doesn't have the right to be where the victim is. What entitles him to be getting an education? He should be banned. That's where I think this is coming from.
Certainly. Certainly.
I mean, she's being stressed out by having to see this guy every day.
But she's not. His brother is, or her brother is.
Oh, well, excuse me. Well, but the family's being stressed out about this.
Yes.
And so we should extinguish his right to get an education, and we should extinguish our efforts to try to save this young man and to guide him in a positive path. And we should put him in I don't know what, they proposed to put him in, but we're supposed to do something to vilify him further so that we can make the non-victim happy, the family member of the victim. It's nonsense, but this is what's happening.
Yeah, but you would definitely have the argument that he forfeited his rights when he committed that crime.
Well, but he didn't, because he has to go to school. It's required by law. Compulsory education is a law in every state in this country. At different ages, you can drop out of school. It's usually commonly 16. I think it's 16 in Alabama, according to this article. It may be 17 in some states, but he has to go to school.
That's almost like debtor's prison. Almost. If you can't pay the fine, they lock you up. So here it is. He could be forced to not be able to attend school, which would then force him to break another law. So he goes to prison or jail too, because he can't comply with the law on both sides.
Well, theoretically, I hope that wouldn't prosecute anybody for him not going to school if they won't let him. But he's required to go to school, and it's in society's interest that he be in school.
Right. Absolutely. More people, especially a state like Alabama that's like 48th or 49th on the list.
Now, don't say that, Andy. We'll have Alabamians mad at us for saying that, because my state is way down in education as well.
They can't, right?
So he needs to. Society needs to let go of their anger and vindictiveness. The courts decided that he did not need to be incarcerated. Our rule of law has spoken. He's getting a chance to be rehabilitated. He can't be rehabilitated if we don't allow him to be rehabilitated. I mean, what do you folks want?
And just for clarity, so the politicians decided it. Now, where did the politicians come from?
What did you say? The politicians decided what?
The politicians decided to write the law so that he did not end up going to prison. They could have written a law that said, if you do this, you do go to prison. But they didn't write the law that way. Where did those people come from?
Well, they came from the people. But I would hope they
people voted.
I would hope that we wouldn't write a law that requires a judge to sentence juveniles to prison in most situations, because of all people that should be given individual analysis. If we don't spend the time analyzing a juvenile, if we throw them all in the same pot, then we're really headed down the wrong path. So the prosecution and the defense and the juvenile judge decided that he belonged in the community.
And then we go back to a conversation about the victims and their advocates raising Cain and making a loud voice, and we don't have an equivalent voice pushing back.
We do not. I doubt there's a lot of calls coming into that school district saying, let this boy go to school.
Right. And finally, from the New York Times, sex offender sues hospital that won't let him visit his son, who's 9 years old, and he has a blood infection caused by E. coli. And it wasn't clear how long the hospital had the policy in place. And he was convicted of a sex crime in 1998 and was sentenced to 6 months time served. So then modern day, he goes to the hospital, the children's hospital in Wisconsin, and security guards escorted him from the building. This is unconscionable.
I don't know if I'm speechless myself when I read the story. Unfortunately, the attorney that is on this case has been a guest on Narsil show in action programs, and I'm glad that someone is standing up to the hospital. But I'd like the spokesman, Andy Broadzeller, refused to make any comment, and I'd like to know what the hospital's position is. If it's just a blanket policy, if you have to register, we don't let you in the hospital. But
it's crazy.
I can't imagine how you can separate a person from their child, their 9-year-old, and the child saying, "Daddy, why don't you come see me?" I can't imagine how Broad Zeller could live with himself.
So I'll just assume that since he's in the children's hospital, that he has to register. It's not just like general visitation where anybody can kind of come and go on the floor. So that would be how they found out about it.
Yes, I would say that. I haven't been to a children's hospital in a long, long time, but I would guess that they are much more cautionary about who they allow in the wards than a children's hospital.
Yeah. I know that when my son was born, you know, the labor and delivery was like security access, where you had to like knock on the door and get the receptionist, whatever, the nurse at the visiting station there to buzz you in. So I'm assuming that this would be not quite that degree of security, but something along those lines. And even the father said, "They're using my past record 20 years ago against me. I served my time for it, and I've been transparent about it." This is really horrid. This is awful.
So, well, I hope that his lawsuit is successful. And but depending on the outcome of the young man's recovery, it may be one of those things where I mean, you certainly can't get the time back you lose with your child. Hopefully he can explain to his son why he wasn't allowed to be there, and hopefully that the policy is adjusted to take into account. And then apparently the hospital says that they have exceptions, but the attorney never heard about it, how to go about getting one of those exceptions.
Right, right. All right, so how can people reach out to us, Larry?
They can do it by emailing us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or they can visit the website registrymatters.co, or they can use a phone, if anybody has one anymore that's listening to us on this podcast, at 747-227-4477. I believe that's the last digit that's missing. It is a seven.
It is a seven. All right. So a listener, James, had some feedback, and I was hoping that you could talk about it and give James kind of some feedback on what he had to say.
Well, it was a little bit of a struggle. Did you want? Because what I took out of this was that, if you want to read it, or if you want me to just tell you what I think I'd get from the comment.
I just want you to talk about it, because I don't understand what he wrote.
So, well, I think that he's complaining about the sting operations where you have adults posing as law enforcement, and many arrests are made across the country that to catch a predator would be an example of the stings that we're talking about. And I think he's concerned about the deception that takes place, which is a very gross deception, where they pretend that they're minor children, that they're teenage adolescents. They usually don't pretend they're children, but they'll be a 13, 14-year-old, 15-year-old. And he believes, and I'm reading between the lines, he believes that that deception is injustice and wrong. But there was a rambling part of the email that was hard to decipher, but I believe that he's criticizing the sting operations.
What do you think about the sting operations? And I mean, is that entrapment?
Well, it can be, but since those decisions are made by jurors in most cases, I mean, you can try a case to a judge in some jurisdictions. In some jurisdictions, you actually can. I think in Arkansas, the state would have to waive your a jury. So in a very conservative jurisdiction, the prosecutor might say, "Hell no, I'm not going to waive jury. I want this to be tried to a jury." But in most cases, the fact finder is going to be a jury in these cases. And the jurors just are not sympathetic. Entrapment, as a general rule, is not that someone happens to be a law enforcement officer and you happen to be engaging in planning or engaging in what could be an illegal activity. Entrapment is when the law enforcement induces and provides the inspiration and incentive to do something that the person is not predisposed. So the predisposed is the key. So when you're surfing the internet and you're in chat rooms and you're chatting, and all of a sudden a person who had to be technically 18 or over to be in the chat room says that they're 14. Well, in theory, you could disengage, but most people find that intriguing because it's not a 14-year-old and they're not conversing like a 14-year-old. They're conversing like when someone much older. And then they confess to you after they've sucked you in with how sophisticated they are. They've sucked you in. Then they confess to you that they're 15. And after that rapport is developed, and some people find it very difficult to disengage. They either don't believe it, or they think, "Wow, they didn't make them like that when I was a teenager. I got to meet this teenager."
Right.
And of course, when they meet, of course, there's no teenager anywhere around. But is it entrapment? Well, maybe, maybe not. But the jurors are not sympathetic to the entrapment defense because they say, well, you ought not have been doing it. You ought not have continued the conversation when they told you they were 15 after you've been conversing for 3 hours or 3 days or 3 weeks or whatever the case was. The jurors just don't have a lot of sympathy. So your entrapment defense usually doesn't work when people try it. I've been a part of legal teams where we've tried that on electronic solicitation of a minor, and it's not worked once.
Wow. Okay. Well, there we go. Thank you, James. And if others of you have comments, you can find an email slot on the website, or you can just email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or if you want to leave a voicemail, 747-227-4477. You could also send an SMS message there, too, if you really want to. All right, Larry, compelled speech. This has come up lately a lot more. I guess really the first time I heard about the idea of that the government can't compel you to speak is from the Halloween stuff of having to put a sign out in your yard. But it's rearing its head again with the passport stuff.
So, well, that is an argument that's being asserted about whether it's compelled speech. The courts will ultimately decide that, how strong that complaint is. But there's a case that's in the U.S. Supreme Court right now that may provide us some guidance in terms of what they're going to, how we don't have enough case law on compelled speech is one thing.
I'd never heard of it until like the Halloween stuff, and I started following Narsal.
Yeah, and we, in the absence of case law, it's we just don't know. I truly, I'm not an expert on this, but I can tell you that the more the cases have been about restrictions on speech than
right.
compel speech. But the government can compel people to speak. And so that's why I'm dubious about on the IML. First of all, there are situations where compelled speech is clearly compelled speech. If you're required to put a sign in your yard that you are a sex offender, then the government's requiring you to carry a particular message.
What about driver's licenses?
Well, there's where I'm headed next. Well, in states where the driver's licenses are marked sexual offender and whatever else they might have on there, that's clearly compelled speech. But the biggest body of the case law is on restrictions on speech more than compel speech. So there's a cake case, I think, out of Colorado
mm-hmm.
right now that's before the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's very likely to give us some, because that's one of the things that the cake, the shop owner is alleging, that this is compel speech. I don't have a lot of faith in his claim, no more than I have in the claim on the International Megan's Law that it's compel speech. There's a message that's on the passport that states that a person has been convicted of something, but you're not required to carry the passport. You're not required to own a passport. So now in a state where you are required to carry a driver's license, I think that's a very, very compelling situation, because you have to have the driver's license. The states that require that say that the sex offender, take for example, in Mississippi, you have to have a special sex offender ID card that says sexual offender on it. Plus they mark your driver's license, as I understand it, with sexual offender. So you have two forms of identification, and you are being required to carry a message, and you need that driver's license to go see the doctor, to cash a check, to apply for a job, I mean, you can go on and on with things. Nobody rents movies anymore. I started to say renting a movie, but I think you go to some kind of box machine now where you put something in and it spits one out. And what is that, red box?
Yeah, I was going to say, and it's red.
Yeah. Nobody actually goes to a Hollywood video store anymore and shows ID and rents a video. But I think that in the case of a driver's license and a compelling, a much stronger argument can be made. But I don't think the cake guy's argument is all that strong, because the message on the cake is very neutral. On your wedding cake, you very rarely is a wedding cake going to say and cheers to homosexual sex. They're usually going to say something, you know, I mean, much more neutral. So that objection, based on compelled speech, I think is going to fall flat. I could be wrong, but I think that's not going to gain a lot of traction with the Supreme Court. It didn't gain any traction whatsoever in the Colorado court system.
I hadn't heard that side of it. I've been following that one a little bit, and I know that I've heard artists in other disciplines saying that they wouldn't want to be forced to, you know, if they're secular in nature, that they wouldn't want to be forced to do some sort of radio spot for a religious organization. And I'm very much sympathetic to that way of thinking. Because you could choose to go to a different service to have that done.
But you're talking about a particular message, though.
Right. Yeah, well, so the cake maker is potentially having to put two dudes or two chicks on the cake. I don't really figure – I don't see how that's that big a deal, but that's not for me to determine that necessarily. So he doesn't want to put that message and have his artwork – associated with that message.
So, but he's many layers, disconnected from that. He's not, I mean, no one knows who's speaking. When's the last time someone's known who made your cake?
Certainly. You're right about that. That's true.
So it's not like he's having to put his name on it and say, I support gay same-sex marriage or whatever the issue was about. I think it was about a same-sex couple.
It was. If he has like a public building, if he's not just doing it out of the kitchen of his house, let's just say, but if he has something on a city street where there are taxes being paid by all of the citizens, then that takes away a certain amount of those freedoms about your freedom of speech, I think.
How so?
Well, if the taxpayers are helping fund it, then you can't then assert something that is part of the Equal Protection Clause. Like, you know, the local drugstore can't restrict you based on the various things, age, race, gender, etc., or sexual orientation. That's what the Supreme Court has already determined, is that they are an equally protected class. That's how the whole DOMA thing kicks in, where same-sex marriage was approved.
So far, so good. But on this compelled speech,
right?
We just don't have enough body of case law here on compelled speech, so we can sit and speculate. And that's what listeners understand. We're speculating about what compelled speech is. I can tell you that compelled speech, in and of itself, depending on the content, it can be permissible. For example, if an employer has wage and hour regulations that they're required to post,
okay,
you must post this notice. It's the government's message telling you that you're entitled to be receiving overtime for more than 40 hours a week and whatever. I haven't had one of those notices for
certainly,
a long time, but you can be compelled to carry a message.
Probably so your health warning, your cleanliness rating of your restaurant has to be posted as well.
Yeah. So to say that the government cannot require you to have a message is ridiculous.
Okay. But that's an employer, but what about down to the individual? And I have some examples of where they told companies to do things with like the cigarette packaging, but what about an individual outside of a court setting? That's the only place that I can think of where they can say, hey, you're going to say this thing. And as we had in that article where the guy didn't say something and they shocked him, which is awesome. Love it.
So, well, in terms of compelled speech, without a full developed body of case law, The Supreme Court is going to help us on this to determine. The big body of case law is on restrictions on speech, where government cannot restrict speech, but where government can compel speech, there's a lot less case law that I've been able to unearth on the subject in preparation for this. I found some cases where the West Virginia State Board of Education versus mm-hmm. Barnett striking down requirement that children must recite the Pledge of Allegiance because that's a particular message.
I found that.
But there's just not enough out there in terms of where this cake decorators has gone. But I think it'll help in terms of the IML if the Supreme Court says that this is compelled speech, then. And depending on how much dicta is in there, we might have a stronger case on the International Megan's Law challenge. Possibly.
Right. But the West Virginia one was about a Jehovah's Witness that was asserting a religious message argument against having to pledge, where part of their doctrine says that they will not, forgive me, I don't know the right terms here, but that they aren't required, that their doctrine will not allow them to worship some false idol, so to speak. So they can't stand up in front of the flag. They can't pledge allegiance. They can't put their hand over the heart. I don't even think they're supposed to stand for the pledge, but I've seen them do it out of just respect for the meeting, the organization. Mm-hmm. I can see where the freedom of speech side would kick in on that one, and that one would carry a higher argument. But then on that same thing, where would somebody stand? This goes off sidetracked. If you're Amish and you say that you don't want that Western modern medicine stuff and your kid's got some blood disease and they need a transfusion and you are religiously opposed to having a transfusion, is that compelled speech?
I think that would probably go a little beyond compelled speech. On this compelled speech, there are instances where government, and I think it's the content, the government can require speech. Whether or not the government can require a person to carry a passport that says you have been convicted of an offense, well, time will tell.
Right.
What's the name of this cake case out of Colorado anyway?
Totally don't know. I'll look it up while you talk.
So Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. When we get that case next year, I think we'll have a lot more clarity when we can do another podcast on this. But compelled speech is a doctrine that's out there, but there's just not enough a law that I've been able to unearth. And I know Ms. Bellucci is using that as a claim, and more power to her if it works.
Right.
But I haven't been able to convince myself of how strong that claim is. And in June, at the end of the Supreme Court term, when it released its decision, I may come back on this podcast and say, based on this, I think that's a very compelling claim.
So I used to work for Big Tobacco, and I'm pretty sure during my tenure there were new regulations about the packaging for cigarettes. And I know that somewhere in there I looked up, and what they do in Australia for their messaging of, I mean, you know, like the US would put kind of sort of benign logo, like images, kind of clip art looking things. But in Australia, they would have graphic pictures of, you know, like autopsied lungs from lung cancer kind of things. And so there's compelled speech that a company is required to put these messages that are in direct contrast to what their product is trying to do. So I was just using that as an example of compelled speech where the government stepped in and said, you're going to put this information on the packaging.
Well, that goes back so long. I think the first warnings went on American cigarettes in 1964.
Sounds good. But they would just say hey, it causes, you know, it might cause birth defects. Simple.
The first one was very benign. The warning, cigarette smoke may be hazardous to your health, was
right.
The first one.
Right.
And then they came out with a rotating of like four or five different warnings that mm-hmm. they had on there about birth defects and different things. But under what authority they did that, I was just a little tiny youngster when that came out, so I don't remember. We could do some research on it, but certainly that is, they did compel Big Tobacco to warn consumers, and it may be under some authority that maybe doesn't even exist anymore.
But it would totally be a public health issue in that regard. It's totally public health. So does the public health institution, the CDC and, Surgeon General, that's the word.
Surgeon General, yes.
That they have the authority to then compel a company to have some message. And obviously the answer is yes, because they did and they won.
So, well, on this particular issue, compelled speech, I'm anxious to see where we go with the Supreme Court ruling on how broadly they interpret the cake makers. I'm not convinced of the strength of his argument.
Well, take me to two different topics then. I'm going to guess then the states that have some sort of driver's license, they haven't been challenged effectively or not at all?
I think in most cases, it's been not at all.
Okay.
There was recently an Oklahoma case that made its way to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals from a prisoner habeas corpus action, I believe. And he didn't fare very well.
Really?
And Narsal got involved in that case with an amicus brief. But if you don't develop the case well down below, it's hard to turn everything around on appeal. And I think that was the problem with his case, is that it's one of those pro se things that okay. wasn't done very well
right.
well below. And
oh.
you get garbage in, you get garbage out. And
right.
pro se people are determined that they're going to do something. And since we don't have enough resources to do all the things that people can conjure up in prison they want to do, a lot of stuff gets done pro se.
And then that would be one of those cases where it can hurt you in the end.
It could have. I'd like to have the expert, the one of the attorneys that was on the case on the amicus from the law school, and it's escaping my name at the moment, but have him opine on that if the case was botched from the get-go.
And then the other one that I can think of is like the Halloween stuff in California, where they fought against having signs posted out front saying sex offender lives here or whatever. They pushed back and won against that one under that argument, wasn't that?
They did, absolutely, yes. So compelled speech is a viable doctrine. It's just not well developed, and it's relatively narrow in terms of what compelled speech is. And we may have a broader definition when I say next year, actually it's this year, by June
okay.
of this year.
So
in
it's the
2018.
Summer. Okay.
Yeah. I think it's on for this determination for this go round.
Interesting.
In 1965, Congress required all cigarette packages distributed in the United States to carry a health warning. And since 1970, the warning is made in the name of the Surgeon General.
Right.
So, yeah, I was just a little thing when that started in the 60s. And it was a result of a 1964 report on smoking.
Larry, do you have anything else?
Oh, I'm sure I can think of something, Andy.
Absolutely. Is there anything else that you would like to go over?
So, well, I wish we could dig deeper into compelled speech, but I just feel like we'll know a whole lot more when we get the Supreme Court's interpretation of what it is and what it isn't.
Right.
So
it's really, I'm like I said, I didn't know of it until I first started getting involved and heard someone bring up the term about compelled speech. And it never, ever even dawned on me that was a thing. It just never occurred to me.
Well, it stands to reason if the government cannot prohibit you from speaking, nor should they be able to compel you to speak.
Yeah. And I mean, like literally it's the opposite of they can't compel you to have some sort of message, and which being silent is a message unto itself. So you can, that would be a form of First Amendment, freedom of speech in maintaining silence.
So, and that's what we're arguing on our side, is that you have the right to take your passport and be silent about your history. You shouldn't have to announce it to the world. I'm just not convinced of the strength of the argument.
Sure, that's fine.
But it may get a lot stronger depending on what they decide.
Do you have an opinion based on the right slant of the court?
I hate to do that because
yeah,
sometimes they surprise me.
Yeah, I know. I'm just, I'm catching you on the record for making a prediction. That's odd. No, I'm not trying to do that.
So, they occasionally surprise me. So it could be that we have one of those odd coalitions emerge here that broadens the interpretation of what you could see. Have the conservatives who want to rally around religious freedom. And you could have some of the liberals come at it from a different angle and you get to a five justices through a unique coalition of five. So
okay, I'm with you.
So we could come up with something very bizarre.
Interesting. Very good, Larry. You rock. I appreciate it, and I hope that you have a good night.
Thanks, Andy.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website registrymatters.co. This is episode 15. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.